On Thursday, the 15th of May, The Spectator is hosting a live book club event. Sam Leith will be joined by former Telegraph editor-in-chief and military historian Max Hastings. It will be an opportunity to talk about Max's new book, Sword, D-Day, Trial by Battle, as well as mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The full details are as follows. 7:30 on Thursday the 15th of May at the Shaw Theatre in Euston, London, and tickets start from £27.50, although I believe there are ticket options that include a signed copy of the book. For those tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/bookslive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. I am delighted to be joined today by Charlie Gammell, who is a Middle East commentator we've had on Americano a few times and a contributor to The Spectator and also a novelist. His latest novel, Kabul Returns, is a very amusing and entertaining work. It's a combination of Flashburn meets Withnail and I, if there is such a thing. But we're going to be talking about Trump's Middle Eastern policy because there's a lot going on with Donald Trump in the Middle East. Yesterday, he gave a pretty extraordinary speech in Riyadh in front of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, in which he effectively said, we're not interested in changing your politics. We're interested in commerce. And you, speaking to the Arab countries assembled, you are changing yourselves through business and so on. Charlie, it struck me and a few others, one of our writers, Daniel McCarthy, has done quite a good piece on this morning, that there is an affinity between Trumpism and the Arab world. Trump doesn't drink, for one thing. He likes gold, and he understands the brutal power of oil. But it seems to me that in many ways he could be a more effective president than any of his recent predecessors in the Middle East. And we saw that perhaps a little bit with the Abraham Accords in the first term, but we're seeing something even more, maybe revolutionary, I think would be not too strong a word, going on now. Do you agree with what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think revolutionary is a good word to describe what we're seeing now in the Middle East and what we're seeing with Trumpism more broadly. And his advisors will have been very keen to tell him that the Saudi administration, the Saudi royal family, doesn't like being lectured. And this is something that Joe Biden fell foul of. This is something that Obama fell foul of. And I think Trump is playing into that. We can do deals. We can talk about money. We can talk about geopolitics through the prism of trade and essentially kind of gold, as you say, and money. And that speaks to MBS's vision, not just of Saudi in the region, but also MBS's vision of Saudi Arabia, his rule in Saudi Arabia, because MBS is his big project, is trying to tread a very delicate path between modernizing the economy, but also changing society. And he is facing the classic challenge that a lot of Middle Eastern powers have faced, where you try to modernize too quickly and you do so at the expense of vested elites, i.e. the clergy, which is very important in Saudi Arabia. And something that bin Salman is aware of is a famous letter from the Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi in the 1970s to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia at the time, or the Prince of the King of Saudi Arabia at the time, where Reza Shah Pahlavi said, you need to modernize. Saudi Arabia needs to modernize. You need to take inward investment and you need to look outward and you need to look forward. The King of Saudi Arabia said to Reza Shah, if you try and modernize too quickly and you forget that you are an Islamic nation, you will get toppled by your own people. Mm. And that is obviously a really important lesson that bin Salman has taken on. And he realizes that he needs to diversify away from his oil economy. He needs to provide jobs, schools, roads for his people. And he needs to modernize internally in Saudi Arabia. So what he's hearing from Trump, there's no lectures on human rights. There's no talk of Khashoggi. There is just a, can we work together? Can we do deals together? And can we reshape the region in our shared vision of prosperity, basically?
And there's this huge shared interest on tech and AI. Elon Musk was obviously there yesterday. Sam Altman of OpenAI was there. The head of Palantir, Alex Karp, was there. I mean, all the most powerful people in Silicon Valley, essentially, are now going to Saudi Arabia, talking to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is trying to pitch, a lot of countries are trying to pitch themselves as the Switzerland of AI or something like that. But Saudi Arabia actually seems to have the capital to do it.
Yeah, and I think the capital to invest in these industries, which is something that Trump really wants. And what I think the Saudis are doing is trying to buy influence with Donald Trump. So this is not just we want to invest in it because we want to make money. It's we want to invest in it because we want to have a seat at the table when it comes to what happens in the region. So I think this is not a one-way street. The Saudi Arabian Mohammed bin Salman is a very, very clever operator and very good at what he does. And he is seeing the gain here from Saudi Arabia. And he's seeing that the language that Trump speaks is money, and this is investment in America's economy is something that they really want to do. And obviously there's a dividend here because Palantir has intelligence applications for helping you better understand what your adversaries are doing at home and abroad. So there's definitely a win there for Saudi Arabia. And exactly as Saudi tries to diversify away from a sort of solely oil economy, this is one way to do that. PIF, the investment fund, has not been hugely successful. Some of the investments they've made haven't been brilliant. And this is just a way of how do we kind of hedge against some of the losses that we've had recently, but also gaining political influence at the same time.
And it's also about dealing with terror.
Correct.
The Saudis have been pretty brutal at dealing with terror and their own terror problems, while arguably exporting terror abroad. But it presents a kind of new, brave new world. I'm speaking with overly rose-tinted spectacles here, but the potential of a brave new world where Arab countries take on the brunt of dealing with terror, and they don't just sort of farm it out to the West.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's a broader context here of Yemen and Saudi. And Saudi had some relatively unsuccessful forays into Yemen to try and deal with the Houthis, which showed up their military not to be as good as perhaps everyone thought it was or they thought it was. There have been instances in the past where Saudi oil facilities have been attacked and the Americans haven't stepped in to help them. So there is a real sense that actually we're going to have to do some of this ourselves. And bin Salman, you look at it with the Chinese brokered deal with the Iranians, which seems to be bearing fruit, and I'm sure we'll get onto that. There is a strong sense that we have to do this ourselves, and we have to do it through diplomacy and not through war. Having said that, the Saudis, as we've seen from these arms deals, are still keen to buy Western tech. They're not going to turn their nose up at military hardware because they like that insurance policy at the same time. But absolutely, and it is a positive development for the region that countries like Saudi Arabia are taking a lead in geopolitics and not simply following America and seeing that actually this is our problem and we need to take a share in it, particularly on Iran. And we need to start using diplomacy as a way out of some of these issues, as opposed to relying overly on America or seeking to fight our way through it, which just is not very good for anyone.
I'd like to get onto Iran in a moment, but first of all, I want to deal with two other countries. One is Syria and the other is Qatar. Syria, yesterday, Trump, in this speech, Trump announced, much to MBS's obvious pleasure, that America would be dropping sanctions on Syria and giving Syria a chance, is how he put it. This morning he's met with the new Syrian leader, Al-Shara, mispronouncing. And that is quite a controversial one because, of course, Al-Shara was a member of ISIS. Mm-hmm. He was a terrorist, and a lot of people don't really believe that a leopard changes his spots on that score. Explain the dynamics of what's going on with Syria in the Middle East.
Yeah, so I think Saudi is looking at Syria as this is a country that they would prefer to be peaceful and prosperous than one that can attract jihadis from Saudi Arabia or from other countries and be a sort of a melting pot of Islamist ideas. Saudi Arabia sees a risk in that and sees a risk in this kind of open-ended conflict through the region and would like to play a role as a peacemaker in the region. America, I mean, this is a classic example of Trump's sort of very agile mercantilism. He wants Syria to prosper because he thinks that it can be good for US business. Syria is a broken country that needs to be rebuilt. And don't forget that the Russians and the Iranians staked a lot of capital, human and financial, on staying in it for the long haul with Assad for the point at which the war was finished and they could get lots of money from rebuilding the country. And there's been a case of documents that were found recently in Iranian embassies around Syria which pointed towards that idea that, that the Iranians were really interested in the Marshall Plan because they saw the positive impact it had on Europe and the money that America could make from that and Europe could make from that. And this is what they were trying to copy in Syria. So there's money to be made there, and I think this is a sort of Trumpian version of Pax Americana, to which Saudi Arabia is happy to sign up. So there's obviously a bigger issue here of Turkey being the emergent power in the Middle East. Turkey has shown that it was incredibly effective at toppling Assad through long-standing support for and funding for HTS and groups in Syria that were going to basically knock Assad over. However, Turkey just doesn't have the financial muscle to step in and rebuild Syria. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of potential convergence of interest there between Saudi Arabia and Turkey, but the relationship between Saudi and Turkey is complicated and it's one of rivals as opposed to partners. Mm-hmm. So I think it should be seen through that prism as well. And also, the Saudis are very keen that they can step in to a place where Iran has so palpably failed. Mm. And that just gives them a win in the region that they like.
And when it comes to Qatar, the story of the week, which is, seems like a perfect metaphor,
yes,
for what's going on, is Qatar offering Trump a new Air Force One, a kind of a palace in the sky type aircraft that Trump obviously said, oh, lovely, I'll take that.
I'll take that.
And it was sort of reported last week, and then the weekend a few American journalists and so on and Democrats decided, actually, hang on, this is outrageous.
That looks a lot like bribery.
Yeah, it looks a lot like bribery. And it obviously essentially is bribery. But it's very interesting the way that Qatar has, because in many ways it's been seen as the bad man for its, you know, role in hosting Hamas and so on. But it's been quite clever, Qatar, in courting elements of Trump world, obviously throwing lots of money at it. And it's effective too, isn't it?
Yeah, and in 2016, Trump definitely got on the side of the Saudis to effect a blockade of Qatar due to Qatar's support for Islamist groups. Mm. So there's that dynamic as well. And this is a preemptive strike on Qatar's part to say, hey, we're here too, and we can help you out, and we know the language you speak, and we can you know, give you what you might want. I think also Qatar is concerned at the risk of sort of obsolescence. And if these talks with Israel on Hamas sort of go nowhere, perhaps it's lost a bit of its hedge and its leverage, I suppose. It had good relationship with the Taliban, which was great while the Taliban weren't in power. Now the Taliban are in power, it's lost a bit of leverage there. If the talks between Israel and Hamas and the war just carries on and people start, and that changes in any way and Qatar loses its sort of leverage there, it is concerned about potential isolation and losing its influence in the region. So this is definitely a way of saying to the Americans, we're here, we're on your side, and let's have a conversation when you come here.
Mm. And are the relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia changing, improving in recent months? It feels like they are, because, I mean, obviously they have been, Qatar's very concerned that Saudi Arabia eventually will swallow them. And yet there's talk about this sort of circle of friendship with the UAE, who's also been an enemy of Qatar with the blockade and so on. Mm-hmm. Is there a detente going on?
There are obviously lots of long-standing issues between them, and I think particularly between Saudi and UAE. The issue is in Sudan, where they're on different sides of a civil war there. Saudi Arabia has concerns about the way the UAE is funding the RSF, or the support that it's given to the RSF in Sudan, and thinks that that is not a good thing for the region and peace in the region more broadly. But again, the mood music is one of, can we solve these issues through talking? Can we solve these issues through diplomacy, not through something more adversarial that puts a strain on our finances at a time when, if the oil price goes down, Saudi Arabia has a kind of a potential long-term problem. They're starting to import energy now because of the strain that Vision 20 is putting on their energy consumption. Mm. And potentially if the Iranians come on stream, it's a long-term thing or a medium-term thing, that will drive up production and drive down the price, which is obviously good for America, but potentially not great for Saudi Arabia. So everyone is trying to say, hey, can we talk about this as opposed to anything more adversarial, because we think that's the best way through this. But having said that, a lot of the drivers, and I think I talked about this in my article, these agreements, if they're only a plaster over a wound and they don't address the kind of drivers of conflict or the things on which they fundamentally disagree, there will be a shelf life to some of these agreements, potentially. Mm.
And it seems to me that in the first term, the Abraham Accords, it was all very much as Israel would have liked it to have been orchestrated. Now we're picking up on differences between Netanyahu and Trump. Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy to the Middle East, seems to have fallen out in some ways with Netanyahu's administration. Israel recently pressured, we understand, America to join in its a bombing campaign on Tehran's nuclear facilities, and Trump demurred. Israel's not quite got the same leverage over the Trump administration it had in the first term. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. And but first of all, I think we should see this through the prism of a lot of these Arab states that are very, very conscious of their domestic audience. They obviously have a regional desire for, as I've said, peace and prosperity, but they're also very concerned that any alliance with Israel at a time when Netanyahu is stepping up his campaign into Gaza would look has very bad optics for their domestic audience. And they are still very conscious of the Arab Spring. They're still very conscious of domestic, of managing that. You know, how do we kind of stay stable at home and prosperous at home, and then kind of sort of influential in the region? All the powers in the region, I think, have that concern. So this is a preoccupation of the Arab nations, is how do we can't ally ourselves overtly with Israel because of what's going on in Gaza. And that's the case for Saudi, and you've seen it in Saudi saying, look, we will only normalize ties with Israel if we have agreement on sort of a progress towards a two-state solution and Gaza, and we have to have some tangible progress on Gaza. Absolutely, there is daylight beginning to appear between the Trump administration and Netanyahu's administration, and a lot of that is to do with, if you look at the way Netanyahu played the Biden administration, there was all the red lines that Joe Biden put up, Netanyahu just went over them. And an indication of where I think Trump's relationship with Netanyahu is today is the fact that on the same day that Trump is in the Middle East announcing these lovely deals, talking about peace with Iran, having a conversation with the leader of HTS, the Syrian leader, Sharar, at the same time, Netanyahu has very categorically said, we will step up our campaign into Gaza. Mm. And that is absolute evidence of daylight beginning to appear. We've had it with the Houthis on the same day that Trump agreed some kind of an agreement with the Houthis, which is not quite sure what it looks like, but a ceasefire agreement. Israeli planes were bombing Houthi positions in Yemen. So daylight is beginning to appear between the two. Where that leaves Netanyahu, I'm not sure. I don't think, I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think that Netanyahu would look to bomb Iranian facilities without Trump's backing. However, there is always the possibility, you look at what Witkoff was saying last week in advance of the fourth round of the talks, was we're not threatening the Iranians by saying, if we fail to reach a deal, we will probably bomb you. That is an expression of the reality of our negotiating position. So I think that's where I think Witkoff has been quite clever, because he's saying this is not a threat. This is what reality is. So America's been quite good at leaving that on the table, as lots of administrations have talked about. But I think that the sort of mad dog theory of the Trump administration is that no one can afford to call his bluff, because you just don't know what he'll do. We saw him do it in Afghanistan. We've seen him do it in Afghanistan twice. And then we've seen him do it in Iran or in Iraq with Soleimani. So somehow this kind of irrational aspect to Trump is playing to his advantage now in negotiating scenario with the Iranians. But going back to the point on Israel, absolutely, I think there is daylight appearing between the two nations. And I remember at the time, you know, we thought that Trump was just going to go along with a lot of what Netanyahu was seeking to do. But the personality types of those two leaders, it's clear that there was going to be a falling out at some point.
Well, on Iran, it seems as though there's some confusion as to what the Trump administration will accept, perhaps a strategic ambiguity even as to what the Trump administration would accept on nuclear facilities. What's the position of the Iranians?
I think the position of the Iranians is that they need the Islamic Republic needs inward investment into the country. Its economy is faltering. It is beset by kind of structural economic difficulties, which mean that inflation is obviously going through the roof. Unemployment is pretty high as well, and it needs some kind of inward investment to stabilize the economy. However, the position of Khamenei all along has been, we do not want to do a deal with the devil, i.e. the Trump administration. They fought a revolution in 1979 effectively to kick out the ills of Western imperialism, or capitalist imperialism as they saw it. And Khamenei sees, for every kind of bit of US or Western investment coming into Iran, the potential for kind of cultural dilution and the dilution of the values of the Islamic Republic. There's a sort of dissonance there, because the behaviour of the Islamic Republic in Iran has already diluted the values of the revolution itself, because there was a great piece recently, a kind of a vox pop of young Iranians. A lot of them couldn't distinguish between Khamenei and Khomeini. Mm. And they actually didn't really know who Khamenei was. So they're trying to protect something that might have already disappeared. But that is the position of the Iranians. They know that they need a deal, or at least Khamenei does. But they also are worried about, is that going to lose them face on the Arab street? Is that going to, and I use the word Arab street advisedly, is that going to lose them face internally? And is that going to lead to a kind of a sort of a Trojan horse overthrown by stealth of the Islamic Republic? Is that the kind of slippery slope towards a sort of Pahlavi type economic bonanza, free-for-all, where it's just, it's not Islamic anymore, it's just this kind of sort of mishmash of East and West. So that is the concern that the Iranians have. And they don't want to reach a bad deal. And what that looks like is giving away too many concessions on their Iranian enrichment, because they don't see this as the point at which the deal signed, you know, we can sort of get on with our lives. They see this in a longer term view, and they don't trust the Americans longer term. Mm. They want to keep something in their back pocket so that if relations go bad with the Americans, they don't have, they're not left with nothing. And I think the reason I wrote about it in my article, the Libya deal, the Iranians are obsessed with what happened to Gaddafi, because at the time they were advising Gaddafi, do not, whatever you do, give up your chemical and biological weapons program. Do not give up your nuclear program, however nascent it is, because there will come a time when you will need that to stop the West from sort of toppling you from the air. Mm. And when Gaddafi fell, the Iranians basically said to the remnants of the Gaddafi regime, you should listen to us. Mm. And that is a big thing in the minds of the Iranians. If they concede too much, they leave themselves open, particularly at a time when they are quite weak at home and they look quite naked in the region.
And they don't trust the Americans, clearly, but do they trust China? Because a lot of what's going on in the Middle East at the moment is a kind of 19th century scramble for influence between the great powers in the Middle East, although the Middle Eastern powers themselves, because they have so much money, have their own leverage.
Absolutely. I think the analogy is correct. And as you rightly say, however, now there is much more agency. This is definitely a two-way street. In terms of does Iran trust China, the Islamic Republic knows that it has to do deals with China and Russia because that's the kind of side of the street that it's chosen to walk on. There is a world where I think a lot of very pragmatic Iranian IRGC/businessmen who see their children going to schools and universities in the US, the UK, Europe, they have more of a cultural affinity for those ideas than they do for that's sort of what we see in China, and definitely what we see in Russia. So there's more of an intellectual and ideological or intellectual affinity and cultural affinity with Europe particularly, but they know that China buys their oil, and if they don't sell their oil to China, then who are they going to sell it to? I mean, obviously at a massively discounted rate. They are in a sort of a bigger struggle against the West ideologically and really, and they've chosen to side with the Russians and they've chosen to side with the Chinese. Their relationship with Russia is incredibly ambiguous and not universally popular within the Islamic Republic. So they realise that this is a relationship of convenience, and it's a strategic hedge. Mm. It's an insurance policy against anything going wrong with America. So it's good for them because it increases that. I think they're in a, you know, regionally they've got that out. Someone can buy their energy products at a discounted price, but they don't necessarily trust the Chinese. They don't necessarily trust the Russians because they know that this is a very opportunistic relationship between the two powers, or the three powers.
And on Russia, I thought it was very interesting that Trump had his big phone call with Putin, hyped phone call about Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And the kind of readouts afterwards and the briefing afterwards, the American side were very keen to stress that they'd come to agreements on Iran. Because it seems as though, for all the talk of sort of Trump giving Putin everything he wants on Ukraine, Trump is also keen to push Putin to help him on Iran, to not be his adversary over Iran.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's in it for Russia is Russia is not keen on Iran being bombed by the US. That's something it's been very clear on. And I think the conversation between Putin and Trump, a lot of it is Putin saying, look, Ukraine is a European issue. The really big issue here is I can help you with the Iranians and let's be friends again. So deliberately trying to blindside Trump on Ukraine and to get purchase on a broader relationship between America and Russia, but then also to show him that to show Trump that Putin has value in helping resolve the issue in Iran.
The one power block we haven't talked about is Europe, because Europe is increasingly, it seems, irrelevant as these great powers sort of carve up the world between them.
Yeah, and I think, as you said at the start, this is a fascinating moment in potentially the death of ideology and the death of ideas. And when we talk about the rules-based order, where are ideas now in a world of kind of fairly brutal mercantilist diplomacy, and where might is right? Personally, I'm probably always quite wary of megalomania, and whether it's pointed at the sunlit uplands of liberal democracy or whether it's pointed at Donald's bank account, I think megalomania writ large is not a great way to solve things. But Europe, what does Europe have that Iran might want? I mean, Europe has potentially, you know, there's a huge, it's a vast trading bloc, and it's an economic powerhouse that the Iranians might want to take advantage of if primary sanctions come off. But I think in a funny kind of way, we've realised that the world is still governed by the dollar economy, because everyone's really, really concerned about the Iranians. Particularly, they want those OFAC sanctions to come off, because then actually we can start really talking about trade between Iran and America. And in the first round of JCPOA, those long-standing OFAC sanctions, which will go back to the 1980s and Iran's sponsorship of terrorism, they were the things that Iranians would say, how can JCPOA ever really fly if we've got these long-standing sanctions? So I think Europe hasn't quite made its mind up on what it wants to do on Iran, because it doesn't really have much leverage whilst American and Iranian diplomats are talking, but it needs a seat at the table because it does, and it thinks it does. But but it is a really interesting, where are we now in the history of geopolitical ideas, and what is the governing idea?
Well, it looks to me as though the new ideology is not necessarily an ideology, but it's tech. That's what binds these countries together. In the Middle East, it's sort of talking about robot taxis, or you know, how your Optimus Prime robot will be your personal friend and so on. And it's almost a sort of utopian vision of what a sort of techno future would look like. It's techno futurism, really, is the new neoliberalism.
Yeah, and I'm just as suspicious of techno futurism as I was of neoliberalism, precisely because, you know, even more so because it's totally unmoored from any ideas of democracy and accountability. And it is some of the stuff that comes out of Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, their mouths, does concern me. And you think it's not long before they would say, well, actually, we don't need nation states. We can have tech states. Mm. And that can be governed by this sort of, you know, weird Lord of the Flies type. And the intermesh of the sort of admixture of this kind of might is right that you have on Trump and these slightly strange ideas that come from Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley, I think that is quite concerning. You've only got to look at what mobile phones have done to the minds of young children to see that the next stage might be even more frightening than the previous one. So even though I think there's cause for optimism in terms of the way in which the Middle East is looking to reorganize itself, we are entering potentially uncharted territory if we're looking to outsource our relationship between each other to robots and to tech, because that is a potentially frightening brave new world, if you want to call it that.
Charlie, it's always fascinating talking to you. Congratulations on your new novel, and thank you very much for coming on to Americano.
Great to chat to you, Freddie.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroze, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.